Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee Podcast. This episode features the 2014 Religious Liberty Council Luncheon keynote address delivered by Melissa Rogers, the Executive Director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. In her speech, delivered June 27th in Atlanta, Georgia, she stressed the importance of religious liberty and explained how her office strives to reach out to those in need.
Members of the Religious Liberty Council, staff, and supporters of the Baptist Joint Committee, it is my honor and pleasure to bring you greetings from President Barack Obama. Thank you. And let me say on my own behalf how happy I am to be here today. I feel like I'm home again. It is great to be with you all. I've gotten to see so many friends. You've told me about how you've been thinking about me in this work and praying for me, and I just want to say how deeply grateful I am for that. Thank you to each and every one of you for what you have done to support me in the past and for the way that you continue to support me in my life. It means more to me than I can explain. I also want to thank the leadership of the Baptist Joint Committee for the kind invitation to be here. I especially want to thank Brent Walker, Holly Holman, Taryn, Sherilyn, and Charles for their fine leadership of the Baptist Joint Committee. And I also want to recognize the tremendous legacy and continuing leadership of my friend and colleague, James Dunn. Each of these leaders has taught me much, and I'm in their debt, and will always be in their debt, as I am in your debt as well, for the things that you have taught me. You know, working for the Baptist Joint Committee years ago was a wonderful experience for me. Brent and James gave me a great break to start work in this fascinating world. I just can't thank them enough for their generosity and for the support that they gave me at that time and for how, again, they have taught me through the years. But I do have one regret. Brent and James, I wish you had redone the office when I was there. Instead of waiting to do the state-of-art facility after I left. Now, I realize it would be unseemly to whine, and I will not whine, but I'm going to keep lobbying Brent to put up some before and after pictures. I think that is really necessary to understand what a great facility the Baptist Joint Committee has in Washington today. Seriously, though, I appreciated the Baptist Joint Committee when I was a staff member there, but I appreciate it in many new ways as an alum, and especially as I work in the White House. I can safely say that there is no more respected voice on religious liberty in Washington or in the country than the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty. Thank you for the work you do every day to defend and extend God-given religious liberty for all people, furthering that Baptist heritage that Holly mentioned that champions the principle that religion must be freely exercised, neither advanced nor inhibited by government. We are a better nation because of the work of the Baptist Joint Committee. Likewise, while I have always appreciated the rich religious diversity of this nation, my appreciation has grown to new heights during my work at the White House. I'm pleased to report that when it comes to the freedom that allows diverse faiths to thrive, the state of our union is indeed strong. In my job, I work with Baptists, Buddhists, and Baha'is, Jews, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Jains, Methodists, Mormons, and Muslims, Sikhs, secular humanists, and Seventh-day Adventists, to name just a few. And the very good news is not just that, but also that it's not just national groups and megachurches that believe that they can engage with government and make a meaningful impact and get a serious hearing. It is also the smallest of congregations and associations that believe that, and they are right. And that's something that we can all celebrate as Americans. I'm also pleased to report that for the first time, I believe is the first time in history, the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships has staff members from all three Abrahamic traditions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Further, I'm glad to say that on a daily basis, people of all faiths and none engage the White House on a wide range of policy issues. Several months ago, the Cooperative Baptist-owned Susie Painter sat in the Oval Office with the President and other religious leaders to talk about the need for comprehensive immigration reform. We recently held a meeting of leaders of the United States government and leaders of Protestant, Catholic, and Muslim traditions from the United States and the Central African Republic to talk about the ways in which faith communities can unite to quell the unspeakable violence that has scarred that African nation. And I'll never forget a special meeting during the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, when many of the religious and civil rights leaders came to the White House to meet with the first African American president of the United States. I was privileged to be in that room when we noted that that day we were truly experiencing a partial fulfillment of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's glorious dream. The rich religious diversity of our nation and our tradition of coming together across many different faiths and beliefs to tackle problems and to better our nation and our world, all of that, it's not an accident. It's an achievement. It's a product of our system of religious freedom, the system that we ordained and now work so diligently to maintain. This group knows so well, we protect this freedom chiefly through the two clauses in the First Amendment, the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses. The freedom to exercise our faith is easy for most people to understand. As President Obama said earlier this year, we believe in the inherent dignity of every human being, dignity that no earthly power can take away. And central to that dignity is freedom of religion, the right of every person to practice their faith how they choose, to change their faith if they choose, or to practice no faith at all, and to do this free from persecution and from fear. The Establishment Clause is often thought of as a source of protection for those who are not religious, and it does function in that way, and properly so. But the Establishment Clause is also essential for faiths to thrive. No government-established faith is free. It's a creature of the state. State establishment of religion not only harms the faith that is not favored, it also undermines the faith that the government embraces. The fact that faiths are free from government endorsement creates the conditions for religious voices to have credibility and power on public as well as private issues. And here, I know I'm preaching to the choir. The president understands this well. I remember back in 2006 listening to then Senator Barack Obama at a Sojourners conference when he said, "The separation of church and state has played a critical role in preserving not only our democracy, but the robustness of our religious practice." He continued, "Folks tend to forget that during our founding, it wasn't the atheists or the civil libertarians who were the most effective champions of the First Amendment. It was the persecuted minorities. It was Baptists like John Leland who didn't want the established churches to impose their views on folks. It was the forebears of the evangelicals who were the most adamant because they did not want state-sponsored religion hindering their ability to practice their faiths as they understood them." Now, by the way, as a Baptist, it seemed then, and it still seems to me today, that any office holder who name checks John Leland has to be somebody pretty special. So put together, the Establishment and the Free Exercise Clause ensure that people of all faiths and none are equal as citizens before their government, and that religion is an independent and authentic force in American society. And we are indeed fortunate to have a system of ordered liberty like this. And this is our duty to maintain this system And I thank you for being here today as your signal that you will work to fulfill that duty. Well, today I'd just like to mention a few of the ways in which our commitment to religious freedom and church-state separation has shaped our work at the White House. The first relates to the Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, the office I direct. Now, at the outset, let me be clear. The mission of the office is not to promote faith. That's the job of religious individuals and institutions, and properly so. The mission of our office is to form partnerships with community groups, both faith-based and secular, to serve people in need. So in other words, our aim is to help people who are struggling, and we reach that aim or work on that aim by forming partnerships with non-governmental organizations. Now, in years past, the focus of the White House office has tended to be on government funds and how more religious groups could compete for those funds. And at times, the measure for success was, are faith groups getting more government money? Under President Obama's direction, the office operates differently. Religious groups are, of course, still welcome to compete for government grants, as they have long been able to do. Let me be quick to note, however, that our office does not give out government grants. We play no role in that process, and properly so. Our focus, however, has been on forming non-financial partnerships with faith-based and community groups, ones in which no money passes hands from the government to the religious or community groups. After all, many religious groups and other groups don't want to get government money, but they do want to find ways to work with the government to help people in need. Now, some ask from time to time, why should the government partner with faith and community groups to serve people in need? Is this just a nice form of outreach? No, it's actually a crucial way to reach people who are struggling. The government has benefits and services that are critical to many Americans. But those benefits and services mean nothing if the people who need them don't know about them and cannot access them. And as you know, this is one of the key places where faith and community groups come in. Faith and community groups are often the crucial link between government services and the people who need them. After all, most Americans don't spend their time frequenting the websites of federal agencies. But they do have ties to, usually, to one faith or community group. Thus, they're more likely to hear about a new flu shot or veterans benefits, or job training programs, or college aid applications through, for example, a church or community group. And because these faith and community groups, including you good people in the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, make it your work and your mission to help people have a better shot at life and a better shot at dignity for all of their family. You stay engaged with people. So, for example, you don't just tell a promising young student without money to go to college about the free application for federal student aid or the FAFSA form, as you all know it. You assist that student in filling out that form, and you make sure it gets in the mail. And that is one of the ways in which faith and community groups make a real difference working with government. And I want to thank you for that. And thank you for the many countless ways in which you help people in need across this nation. So President Obama's emphasis on this need to form non-financial partnerships has opened doors for us to work with many more faith and community groups, and I hope to do much good. Another thing that President Obama has asked us to do, as Holly mentioned, is to make some reforms of the financial partnerships that the government does form with faith and community groups. And these are actually reforms that were recommended by a very diverse advisory council on faith-based and neighborhood partnerships that I had the honor to chair. And Brent was very key to this work, too, so I want to thank him again for that. What we are doing now, it's an interesting role for me to have worked on recommending these changes. The president then agreed and embraced these changes, and now I'm working with federal agencies to make sure that these changes actually get written into federal regulations and guidance and policy and practice. It's a fascinating experience. Well, I don't have much time to talk about all the different reforms we're doing, but I want to mention one of them just to give you a better idea of some of the work we're doing. Up until now, most beneficiaries of social services were not informed about protections for their religious liberty rights when they went to faith and community groups to get federally funded social services. But now, because of the president's direction, agencies will ensure that beneficiaries receive written notice of this protection when they enter a program. And that notice will say to beneficiaries in plain language that the organization from which they receive services may not discriminate against them on the basis of religion or religious belief. The organization may not require them to attend or participate in any explicitly religious activities that are offered by the organization, and any participation in them by beneficiaries must be purely voluntary. The organization, if they do offer religious activities, must separate in time or location those privately funded explicit religious activities from activities supported by direct federal financial aid. And if the beneficiary objects to the religious character of an organization, the organization must take steps to identify and refer the beneficiary to an alternative provider to which the beneficiary has no objection. And of course, these steps are taken because no one should ever be pressured along religious lines in order to receive government benefits. So these are some of the reforms that we are working hard every day to implement. Now, let me note that there are still arguments over some significant issues in this area, and we will continue to deal with those issues as well. But meanwhile, we are putting these important reforms in place. Another part of our work is to make sure that policymakers are aware of the ways in which policy may affect religious institutions, individuals, and ideas, and that they have thoughtful options to consider when managing those intersections. After all, as you all know, religion runs through every human endeavor. What does that mean? That means religion can pop up in any area of policy and law, whether it's domestic or international. It keeps us busy. For example, changes to childcare policies may affect the childcare centers that are often run by congregations. Changes to our policies on international development may intersect with the humanitarian and missionary work that faith groups often do. We all know that changes to policy about employer-based health insurance impact the kinds of insurance that religious institutions provide as employers. And there are many other changes. Food and nutrition policy may affect religious beliefs and practices, like beliefs and practices related to kosher or halal food. So in all these things, especially because of the American commitment to the letter and the spirit of the First Amendment, it is crucial for policymakers to be mindful about the way in which policy and law impact religious activities, institutions, and ideas, and it is essential for us to remember that the First Amendment creates boundaries within which the government must operate. Now, to be sure, Americans don't always agree about exactly where these boundaries are. That also makes our work interesting. That's part of our freedom, too, of course. And that makes this task difficult, but it also underscores its importance. Let me close with a brief note about a related part of our work. Together with the National Security Council, the State Department, and others, we promote religious freedom as a key objective of U.S. foreign policy. As the President said earlier this year, we are proud that no nation on earth does more to stand up for the freedom of religion around the world than the United States of America. Many of you, I know, have been following a horrifying case involving a Sudanese woman, Maryam Yahya Ibrahim Ishag. The government of Sudan sentenced her to flogging for adultery and to be hanged to death for apostasy simply because she refused to renounce her Christian beliefs and married a Christian man. The White House and the State Department condemned this sentence as an outrage and called on the government of Sudan in the strongest possible terms to respect Ms. Ishak's right to freedom of religion, a universal right enshrined in Sudan's own constitution. But since 1999, Sudan has been designated as a country of particular concern by the United States for its ongoing egregious and systematic violations of religious freedom. This case has rightly drawn tremendous attention, both in the United States and around the world, with religious and human rights leaders helping to put a spotlight on this case and to press governmental leaders for action. And this has helped us to bring about some important advances in this case, including the recent release of Ms. Ishag from prison. There's still work to be done, however, in this case to secure her and her family's swift and safe departure from Sudan. Our embassy has been and will remain involved in working with the family and interfacing with the government. And we will continue to work to ensure that her family is able to depart Sudan safely again and swiftly. And of course, we will continue to urge Sudan to fulfill its constitutional promise of religious freedom and to respect the fundamental freedoms and universal human rights of all its people. Your key role in this case and so many others helps immeasurably to bring about greater justice and peace in our nation and our world. Never forget how much your voice matters. When you take the time from your busy life to stand up and to speak out, it makes an impact. It matters. We hear you. It matters at the White House, and it matters in the world. So as I conclude my remarks today, I would like to just ask you to continue to monitor this important intersection and these rights of conscience as you have so faithfully for years, and to continue to take the time to stand up and speak out on behalf of religious liberty. Thank you so much.
That was Melissa Rogers, Executive Director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, delivering the keynote address at the 2014 Religious Liberty Council Luncheon in Atlanta, Georgia. Following the speech, Rogers received the J. M. Dawson Religious Liberty Award from the Baptist Joint Committee. For more about this annual event, including videos of past speeches, visit our website at bjconline.org/luncheon.